Okay, if you weren't here 2 weeks ago when I was here, we've launched into a new text on creation theology, and that is Proverbs 30. So we'll be getting into that text. A couple of scientific discoveries I want to talk to you about, and then really quickly, what happened last week. I was in Washington, D.C., attending a conference sponsored by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. You say, who is the American Association for the Advancement of Science? It's the world's largest organization for professional scientists. And they put out the journal Science, which is ranked as one of the two top science journals in the world. But what's interesting, and I'm a member of the AAAS, but what's interesting is that they've gotten a grant to start a dialogue between religion and science. So they actually have several full-time staff people that are doing that, and they sponsored a conference. 250 people were invited and 40 speakers. And the 40 speakers were jammed into the morning and the afternoon. So, you know, we just did our AMP conference a month ago, and so I kind of had a chance just to see, okay, maybe the way the AAAS is doing it really isn't the best way to do it. It was advertised a dialogue. So I thought, well, you know, we're actually going to have some time to dialogue with one another on these issues. Instead, they had nearly 40 speakers, each of which had like 5 minutes to give a soundbite. And then they said, okay, now we're going to have some dialogue. The dialogue consisted of people filling out a 3x5 card with a question. They selected through the 50 or so questions they got and picked one or two. So the only dialogue we have really was at lunchtime. But they also had a little evening reception, which was actually the best part of the whole thing, because we literally had 2 hours to sit around tables with no agenda and just talk to one another. And that was very productive. A lot of pastors were there. I got to talk to a lot of them, and a lot of them were really eager to partner with Reasons to Believe. So that was a good meeting for me to attend. But also good, too, just to see the degree to which the church is now being challenged with Darwinian evolution as an explanation for the origin of life and the history of life. And I had a lot of pastors and theologians come up to me and just say, are we really forced to accept this? Are we going to have to change the creeds of the church? And basically said, no, check out our website, check out our books. You know, this is really not the whole story. And we really need to have a dialogue on this, and a dialogue at the level of the AAAS. So hopefully we'll see some actually meaningful dialogues going on in the future. The rest of my time there was spent speaking in churches and addressing two of our chapters. We now have two Reasons to Believe chapters in the Washington, D.C. area, and I got to address both of them, and they're going to start a third one. But they're also really excited about bringing out the AMP conference to the D.C. area. And, you know, we thought it was radical at our AMP conference to have all of our speakers cut their talks from 60 minutes down to 30 minutes. But the people's feedback was, you know, it was really good. I can handle 30 minutes. It's realizing, okay, you can go too far like the AAAS did and make it just 5 minutes. And, you know, nothing all that meaningful gets discussed. We think the 30-minute thing is good. But we also got some great feedback from the conference we did here. Is we had 10 speakers in the space of 24 hours. We're thinking it's going to be more effective if we cut that back to 8 speakers instead of 10, especially if we're taking on the road, because now the travel expenses is greater, but actually have more time for Q&A and dialogue with the people that attend the conference. So in one sense, I think attending this AAAS thing really is going to help us. Yes?
Would that be for 2016? Is that where it's going to be?
Well, we're thinking maybe of having an AMP conference actually annually in Southern California, but having, say, a couple that we would take on the road. But, you know, the whole point is it's more expensive to take it on the road, and also it takes more time to prepare. But it looks like the D.C. chapter has already contacted some mega churches about sponsoring it. So they're already developing partnerships. So that's good. Yes?
Did you get to speak at that one where the 40 people were at, and with those 5 minute things, were these young earthers, old earthers, or what were their things that they were?
There were no young earth creationists there. I mean, the money that funded this conference was from an organization that's really taking a theistic evolutionary perspective. So I was considered to be too conservative to be invited to be part of one of the 40 speakers. And by the way, they're trying to be ecumenical. So they had Muslims there, as well as Christians, as well as atheists, all speaking on, you know, how we should engage religion and theology dialogue. So I got to talk to the atheists, and they were actually very encouraged that they were invited to come and be part of the dialogue. So we'll see. I'm encouraged for what could happen in the future. So, yes. I'm trying to remember the name. I think there was a church. It's a church in Leesburg, and maybe just Leesburg Community Church. They've had me speak there before, and I. Well, that would have been a bit of a drive. And by the way, this time I went to D.C. The expressways aren't as cheap as they used to be. It's about $1 a mile to drive the expressway. So. Our tax dollars at work. But hey, they're getting our tax dollars back, so so that's good. It was a church in Leesburg, and I actually gave 3 different messages in the 3 morning services, so which was interesting, because we had a lot of people come for the 8:30 service, and they stayed for all 3. So, yeah. All right. A couple of discoveries before we jump into Proverbs 30. One got featured in Nature News and is just a few days ago, and it's describing what's now being referred to as a myopia epidemic. You say, what is myopia? It's nearsightedness. And, you know, typically 10% of the population in 20th century America has myopia. But, for example, in the city of Seoul, it's 96.5%. Now, 96.5% of teenage men in Seoul have myopia to a sufficient degree that they have to wear glasses or contacts. So the question is, what's caused it to go from 10% to 96.5%? The other thing they notice is about 90% of people living in East Asia are suffering from myopia. Now, again, that's limited to teenagers and college-age people, yes.
The technology and the, you know, the farsightedness comes from not doing close-in work. That is hunting and being out there and observing your distance. And that's happened to me. My eyes, I do computer work. My eyes change, and I'm more nearsighted now. And because I look at a computer all day, and I'm not out there looking in the distance and studying things.
Well, this is what was interesting about this report, you know, because literally in a span of just a few years, they're seeing this myopia epidemic. In fact, they're saying that by the end of this decade, over 1/3 of the world's population will be suffering from myopia to a sufficient degree that they're going to need glasses. So it's like it's a worldwide phenomenon, but it's most extreme in East Asia and most extreme in the East Asian large cities. And most extreme with young people, and more extreme with men than it is with women. So what this research study is all about, why? What's going on here that's causing this, quote, epidemic? And they basically identified 2 causes of the epidemic. One is the cell phone phenomena. You know, cell phones are tiny. Because they used to say it's bookish people, like you described. People look at computer screens. People read books. They're the ones that tend to get myopia. But they discovered with the advent of the universality of cell phones and how particularly people in their teenage years and their early 20s are basically spending sometimes hours a day on their little smartphone, whether they're playing games, doing texts, getting emails, contacting their friends. It's amazing how much time they spend on those cell phones. But another researcher said, there's another factor at work, because they said that we're not seeing the same impact, say, here in America that we're seeing in East Asia. What is it about East Asia, especially East Asian cities? And what they documented is that these young people spend almost all their time indoors. Now, for example, I've been to Tokyo, Osaka, Hong Kong. I've been to a few of these big cities. And the way they're oriented is that they've got these tunnels and trains that connect everything. So, for example, when I was in Hong Kong, there really was no need to ever go outside. Everything was connected. And you don't want to go outside because it's hot and humid outside. And so they have all these little air-conditioned tunnels you can walk around in. Everything's connected. And therefore, they're saying maybe there's something about people being inside. And one research report said, okay, if you're in a very well-lit office building, the illumination at most is what's 500 lux. I won't go into what that unit means. But just to give you a point of comparison, if you were to go outside today, even though it's overcast, the brightness is about 10,000 lux. And so if you're in a well-lit office building, lit better than this room, the illumination is 20 times less. And so they said maybe it has something to do with the illumination exposure. And once again, they went back to these smartphones. How well lit is your smartphone? And how well lit is it when you're trying to read it in the typical environment that young people are using it? So they're saying it's not only the fact that they're spending all their time close up, it's the illumination factor. And so what's happening in East Asia, especially in China, there's a campaign now geared at children and youth, go outside. However, one of the problems with East Asia, it's not that easy to go outside. And who wants to go outside if you're in this big crowded area with traffic and exhaust fumes everywhere? It's not like they got nice parks and everything. But they did another study where saying how much time do children need to spend outside to avoid this myopia epidemic? And the answer is 3 hours. Now, you do get a benefit if it's a day. Okay, they do get a benefit if it's only 80 minutes, because they compared 40 minutes with 80 minutes. With 40 minutes, there wasn't much of a difference. 40 minutes is not enough. But with 80 minutes, they saw a factor of 3 improvement in those who suffer from myopia. And with 3 hours, basically, you don't see myopia happening. But yeah, how do you get kids to go outside for 3 hours? Okay, I could survey all of those of you here in the room who are over at the age of 60. What did your parents say to you when you came home from school? Go outside. They didn't want you in the house. Go outside. And we would go outside and we would play, right? And then, come dinner time, your mother calls you in. And so if you actually go back to the early part of, say, the 20th century, it was typical for children to spend hours outside every day. Also, it was pleasant to spend outside every day. It was such that kids wanted to be outside because there was a baseball field here. And moreover, back in a few decades ago, even in the big cities, there were empty lots that were fun to play in. Now it's hard to find an empty lot that's not filled with cars. And so it was actually some natural point. But as I was reading this, yes?
Would sunglasses hurt this process? Or should you take sunglasses off?
They didn't address that here. They're basically saying you need about 10,000 lux. The exposure to that kind of a brightness. And by the way, there's more to it than that. It's like if you're outside where it's 10,000 lux, you're going to be motivated to look at far distant things. And so part of, quote, playing outside for children, they're going to be forced just by their nature of playing to look at things that are more than 2 feet away. Whereas if they're inside with their smartphone, they're basically looking, 8, 10, 12 inches away from something under dim light conditions. So bottom line, they're saying this is what's really causing the epidemic.
The other thing that's important is that you need at least over at least 1 hour a day just to maintain a regular sleep cycle. But if you have less than 1 hour of that bright sunlight, you can't produce melatonin in your body to regulate your sleep cycle. So there's another factor of not having at least one bright of sunshine hour a day, obviously.
Well, that was actually mentioned in this report, is that children, say, are not getting the sleep that children got 100 years ago. And that might account for it, right.
Minimum an hour to 2 hours to regulate your sleep.
Right. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm also wondering about the vitamin D levels.
Because if you're not out in the sun a certain amount of during the day, you don't produce the vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
Taking supplements isn't the same as
Yeah. So you don't get the vitamin D. You can take supplements for that, but it's hard to take supplements that are going to fix your eyes. And by the way, the research actually demonstrates what happens to the eye when you're not exposed to bright light and when you're basically looking at things up close. The shape of the eye during the childhood years changes. And so what happens is the eye actually gets elongated. And when it gets elongated, then the lens of the eye focuses in front of the retina instead of on the retina. And what's happening is during the childhood years up into the teenage years, the eye is still in a process of growing. So one of the things they're recommending here, what if we just had a law that children were not allowed to have cell phones until they reached the age where their eyes were fully developed? So,
you know,
you have a lot of lawbreakers, but the whole point is that children are being exposed to, you know, iPads and cell phones at an age of 4, 5, 6 years of age. And that's the other thing this study was pointing out. The earlier they get exposed to these high-tech small devices, then the greater the onset of myopia. And the whole problem is their eyes are developing. And if their eyes are developing, they're going to adapt to the conditions that they're experiencing. And therefore, they were jokingly saying, maybe we just take away all these devices until they reach 18 years of age. But yeah, I mean, how's that going to work in your teenage kids, right? All right.
What if you were to install solar tubes for indoors? Would that help anyway?
Well, it's, for one thing, it'd be quite expensive to put 10,000 lux, say, in this room.
It wouldn't be as healthy as just going outside, but I'm saying, would it help?
It might, yeah. I mean, if you could actually duplicate the brightness of outside, and that might help, you know, those of us who are older, we're finding we need glasses to read up close. But what you notice about, quote, the older people is they don't need the glasses if they're reading outside because it's bright enough that they can actually read things up close. But it's when, you know, hey, I'll confess, when I'm in a restaurant where they've got dim light, boy, I have a hard time reading that menu. But if I can hold the menu up to bright light, and Kathy always gets after me because I'll take the menu, hold it up to bright light, then I can read it. So, and her comment is, hey, why don't you just get glasses? Well, I'm trying to avoid getting glasses because I know what happens when you get glasses. The eyes adapt. Yes?
Did they talk about whether those, what are they called, little pads that are bigger than phones, that included?
Well, they're basically saying that, you know, smartphones, you know, the bigger phones, iPads, what's happening is computers are typically getting smaller because people want them to be portable. I mean, for example, the computer I got here, you can no longer buy this size of a computer.
Really?
Yeah, Apple has discontinued the 17-inch computers and no one else is making them either. And so they're now, you know, computers are getting smaller. And a lot of people carrying around these iPads, which are, you know, just a few inches across. And so the whole point is we're raising a generation of people who, since the time they were little, like 4, 5, 6 years of age, have been spending. Matter of fact, you can actually give one of these devices to a one-year-old. They adapt to it incredibly rapidly. And, you know, I kind of looked at that and saying, that kind of tells us that God designed us for high technology. The fact that even little children can take these devices and immediately figure out how to use them. So,
There's other consequences too, obviously, and the literacy rate for cursive writing is just drastically gone down. And most of the youth in China now cannot draw characters. They can push the button on the key, but they can't draw their characters. And same here in the U.S., we're dropping cursive writing because everybody's using keypads.
Yep. Well, I mean, you can write.
Take notes.
Yeah.
Well,
there's actually people who are going to college now who never take hand notes. That's all done on their computer. And that means they got to carry around a computer smaller than this because you don't want them to have the problem of doing that. So, and yeah, they type incredibly fast. And so cursive writing is disappearing. But yeah, what this article is pointing out, we actually got a big medical problem here in the sense that, what's it going to be like? And by the way, kind of what we're doing here in this class, going through the different creation texts in the Bible, and what you see throughout the Bible is look at the book of nature. And kind of what's happening in this research report is we're raising a generation of young people who have lost contact with the book of nature. They don't go outside. They learn about nature through the internet. Okay, they want to find out what the mountains in Colorado are like. They go to the internet. Instead of visiting the mountains of Colorado, they look at them on their little smartphone or their computer. And it's not the same as actually being out there in nature. And I think that also explains the rise of atheism, agnosticism, or what's actually being referred to as the nuns. Ever heard that term, the nuns? It's a new religious classification where people can put down, we're asked to say, are you a Protestant, Catholic, Orthodox, Muslim, atheist? You have a category for none, which is basically none of the above. I simply don't think about these issues, so I don't have a position on whether or not God exists, or maybe God does exist, but I really don't think about him much. And what's responsible for the rise of the nuns is urbanization. The fact that people are spending their time not just in cities, but in cities that are very crowded. I mean, I think, again, that's this, the problem, what we see in East Asia. It's not just people living in cities, but people living under very crowded conditions where they've got no access to nature. What they see is basically concrete and pavement and high-rises. And so, yes?
That plays very well, it seems to me, into the LA Times article that I saw a few days ago saying we really don't need national parks anymore, we just need little regional parks here and there. So national parks kind of could be a thing of the past, we might as well develop them.
Might as well develop them, eh? All right. Well, I noticed they're starting to put quotas on national parks, so you can't get to them as easy as you could in the past. And, you know, as an amateur astronomer...
See them on your iPhone and the internet. The national park no longer exists. You can still have the archived pictures.
Yeah, you can look at the pictures on the internet. But it's not the same as being there, right? Unless you've actually been there. But something else is in this research report is the fact that people in these big cities, especially the younger people, never look up at the stars. Well, I mean, I've been to Seoul, I've been to Tokyo. It's pointless to look up at the sky. You're not going to see the stars, even if you do look up at the sky. The illumination, 24/7, is so bright, you really can't see the stars. But their whole point is, if you never look at the stars, it affects your eyes. Because the stars are distant, they're dim, and you know, the fact that there's all this beauty up there, as a motivation for people to look up the stars. You take people out in the countryside where it's dark, people can't help themselves. They have to look up at the stars. But the fact that we live in places of the world where that's not even possible anymore.
As you pointed out, people who live in nature, like farmers and park rangers, and are not constantly bombarded with the electronic stuff, you know, worship comes naturally. I mean, there's nothing to do but contemplate your environment. It's a worshipful experience.
Well, that's the theme of what we're doing here in this class. The Bible over and over again says, hey, God's given us the book of Scripture. He's also given us the book of nature. It commands us over and over again to study the book of nature. And the more you study the book of nature, the promises, the more evidence you'll see for the handiwork of your Creator. So it is a worshipful experience. Now, I've shared in this class before that when I was on the faculty at Caltech, I would take other research scientists up into the high Sierras, and you get them up there in this beautiful alpine meadow, and these atheists have a worship experience. And I would just simply ask them a question. Can you explain why this is so beautiful and why it is that you as a human being think it is beautiful? And, you know, it's an easy way to start a conversation that leads into discussions about God and a relationship with God. But that doesn't happen as easily if you're stuck inside a crowded city where there's not a blade of grass to be seen for 30 miles around. And, you know, that's what's different. Our cities have blades of grass and trees, but I've been in cities where that just simply doesn't exist. All you've got is pavement. Not much in the way of parking lots and trains and underground tunnels connecting everything, and inadequate illumination, and literally no contact with nature. Hey, I'm going to leave it there because I got another research. I mean, this is an incredible discovery. I'm going to leave it till next week, though. It has to do with the origin of life. But if I get into that, we're not going to have any time for a lesson. So I want to make sure we get some time here for our lesson. And this is Proverbs 30. I'm not going to read the whole of Proverbs 30. And by the way, notice I'm not using glasses to read this. And I think there's value in spending some time at close work study, because the Bible also tells us we're to be studying. Notice when we look at the book of Scripture, it causes our eyes to look at things up close. When we look at the book of nature, we're looking at things far away. We're to do both. Okay, chapter 30 of Proverbs. Who has gone up to heaven and come down? Who has gathered up the wind in the hollow of his hands? Who has wrapped up, hey, who cut down the lights? Who has wrapped up the waters in his cloak? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and the name of his son? Tell me if you know. So notice, here's another Old Testament text that's talking about two members of the Trinity, God and the Son of God, in the context of God's creation. You know, the doctrine of the Trinity, God the Father commands creation, God the Son fulfills creation. He's the one that actually makes it all happen. So it's basically asking us questions. Who has done all this? And again, it's a challenge to all of us. We look at the book of nature, who is responsible for everything you see? Did this just happen by natural process? Did we human beings do it? Or is it the God of heaven, of the triune God of the that lives beyond the universe? And then we've got three sections that follow in Proverbs 30. And three times where it talks about three things that are amazing, and there's four I do not understand. Okay, there are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand. The way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on a rock, the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. And then it goes on to verse 24, 25. Answer creatures of little strength, yet they store up their food in the summer. Conies are creatures of little power, yet they make their home in the crags. Locusts have no king, yet they advance together in ranks. A lizard can be caught with a hand, yet it is found in kings' palaces. And then it goes on. There are three things that are stately in their stride, four that move with stately bearing: a lion mighty among beasts who retreats before nothing, a strutting rooster, a he-goat, and a king with his army around him. Now, question for all of you here. Three times it talks about three and then four. Now, whenever you see something like that in the Bible, it's always good to say, why is it written that way? Why does it say that there are three things that are amazing, four that I do not understand? So here's a question for you. What's the difference in each of these texts between the three and the fourth? And then we'll jump into that.
So, don't,
yeah, three that are amazing and one you don't understand. So as you go through these three texts, what do the three have in common, and what does the fourth have in common? And what's different between the three and the fourth? Want me to read it again for you? All right, you're getting to it. All right. There are three things that are too amazing for me, four that I do not understand: the way of an eagle in the sky, the way of a snake on the rock, and the way of a ship on the high seas, and the way of a man with a maiden. So what's different about the man with a maiden compared to the previous three? And then we get into verse 25. Ants and conies and locusts and a lizard can be caught with a hand, yet is found in kings' palaces. Then you move on. There are three things that are stately in their stride, four that move with stately bearing: a lion mighty among beasts who retreats before nothing, a strutting rooster, a he-goat, and a king with his army around him. So can you see the pattern? Yeah. Right. Okay. It takes three that are distinct from human beings, and the fourth is always in the context of human beings. So one of the points it's making, something we discussed here before, when we looked at Job 38, 37, 38, and 39, is how the book of Job constantly addresses the issue of human exceptionalism. So there's something about us that's distinct and different compared to all the other animals. But there's things in the animals that we cannot explain through a naturalistic process. And that's basically how it's introducing. An eagle really defies a naturalistic explanation, as does a snake. And then it brings up the point about the ship. What is it about the ship that kind of is the same as the snake and the eagle? Something amazing about the ship. Now you've got to take in the context what it means about a ship in the time that this was written, namely 3,000 years ago. What is it about ships back then? Then it talks about the way of a made man with a maiden. As I warned you the last time we discussed this, you know, since I'm Asperger's syndrome on the autistic spectrum, my way with a maiden is nothing like it is for ordinary people. So I'm going to need your help with this one. I don't have a way with a maiden, so I'm going to rely on all of you. But what it's really making the point about is when you look at the higher animals, you know, an eagle, for example, is in the category of the nephesh animals. And what you see with the birds and mammals, they have a courtship ritual that they go through. We humans have a courtship ritual, but it's very different than the animals. So that's kind of where I'm going to go with this one. What is it about the way that we humans relate to one another in terms of our courtship that makes us radically different from all the other animals on the face of the earth? So I want you to think about that. But before we get to that, what is it about the eagle? And by the way, if we go back to the first part of Proverbs, it's basically setting it up. Who has gone up to heaven and come down? Who has gathered up the wind in the hollow of his hand? Who has wrapped up the waters in his cloak? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is the name and the name of his son? Tell me if you know. And it's basically making the point, before it gets into the difficult science, it's talking about the easy science. Notice what it's talking about here. Can you explain the universe above? Can you explain the weather, the water, the establishment of the earth? That's just chemistry, geology, and physics. So it's not the tough science. It's the easy science. But it's basically making the point, we human beings can't explain that from any kind of naturalistic perspective. And by the way, that's true at the beginning of the 21st century. We still can't explain where the universe came from a naturalistic perspective. That basically is making the point, even the simple science, where the universe came from, how it got to have its characteristics, how the earth got its characteristics, where the wind came from, the water came from, the foundations of the earth. Just looking at that by itself, we realize there has to be a God to explain that. By the way, that's going to be the theme of the next book I'm working on. If you try to phone me this next week, you're going to have a hard time getting through because they got me sequestered, going over all the edits our various editors have done on the book that I finished last September. They've gotten through it. I now got a week to get through all their edits and get it shipped off to the publisher. So, but that book I'm working on is basically about the history of the earth and everything we see in the history of the earth that makes possible the existence of us human beings. And how literally you need God intervening every step of the way throughout the past 4.5 billion years in order for humans to be possible with civilization. So we can actually have smartphones. You know, if God wanted us to have smartphones, it really requires a particular history of the earth and a particular history of Earth's life in order to make all that possible. However, in researching that book, it became ever more evident to me this defies a naturalistic explanation. God has to be involved. But notice, we're talking about the easy stuff. Then you flip the page, and now we're talking about how do you explain animal behavior. It's one thing to be able to explain the operation of stars and galaxies, the operation of the geology of the Earth. What about the animals? Much more challenging. How do you explain the way of an eagle in the sky? Now, I wrote briefly about eagles in my book over there, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, because Job talks about the eagle. But when you look at the eagle, it flies high up with very little effort because it's got these big wings, well cambered, And what it does is the eagle basically waits for updraft. An eagle seems to instinctively know when the conditions in the atmosphere are right that they can take off and basically hover over the earth below, literally for hours on end. And you notice that with eagles. They can fly around for hours without feeding.
And they never use smartphones, so they got better than 20/20 vision and can see a mouse.
Well, I'm going to get into that because they have eyes like no other creature. And this is what really challenges the Darwinian paradigm. How do you explain the eyes of an eagle? What I was getting at is it's even difficult to explain the flight of an eagle, the fact that it can just kind of hover over there. Well, one of the things eagles do, they're different from, say, other predatory birds in that they will pick areas that are basically open land. So, for example, hawks, you'll see them in the forest. But it's rare to see an eagle in a forest unless there happens to be a trout stream or a salmon stream nearby where the pickings are easy. You're not going to see eagles around. That's kind of the territory of the hawks. But the eagles pick places where it's basically open land, where there's not a whole lot of vegetative coverage, and they will literally soar up to thousands of feet above the land, and they're able to spot tiny prey from 2 miles away. So they can spot a mouse from 2 miles away. How do they do that? Because their eyes are designed. Number one, they can see in 6 colors, as compared to, say, 3 for us and fewer for many other life forms. We human beings are unusual in that we can distinguish so many color patterns because our eyes are basically designed to see 3 primary colors. But the eagle's eye is designed with 6 primary colors, which is why it's so difficult for prey to camouflage themselves against eagle attack, because the eagles can see very subtle differences in coloration that even we humans can't see, and our eyes are typically much superior in terms of color recognition than other animals, say like your dogs and cats. But eagles far surpass us in color and pattern recognition. The other thing that eagles have in their eyes is in the little center of their eyes, there's a telescope. Okay? So unlike us human beings, they've got ordinary vision. And in the center of their eyes, they kind of got a telescope, which enables them to see with high definition at far distances. So it's like if you had an eye design where you got ordinary vision, but in the center of your eye, you got a pair of binoculars that can kind of zoom in and see these creatures. And so literally, this eagle can kind of float over these updrafts in the sky and be looking 2 miles away and see a little mouse and then go after that mouse and get it. Yes?
Help me. I'm failing to appreciate why catching an updraft and floating on it is so remarkable. I mean, I can see that maybe it's difficult to explain the evolution of that. Okay. But is that your point? Or
well,
the fact that he's floating on a thermal is not a... remarkable.
It's not a remarkable thing to float in a thermal. It is remarkable to know when to take off to catch one of those long-lived thermals. I'll give you an example. I don't know how many of you have ever done any hang gliding. I've never done it. Don't want to do it. My life insurance policy doesn't work if I do that. But there's also this thing where you have these kind of a parachutes you can take, paragliding. But have you ever done that kind of sport? What you notice is you have to be very cognizant of the atmosphere conditions, the wind conditions, the temperature conditions. Because if they're not right, you're likely to injure yourself because, it might collapse your parachute or your hang gliding equipment. And so what you have are these people who basically will sit on the edge of a cliff and they wait. They wait for the right conditions and they have to know what to look for to get those right conditions. And I know people who do this, and basically what I've found out is I can't read the sky like they read the sky. They just seem to know. They know the temperature. They seem to know the temperature above. They're looking at the leaves and the trees, and they're looking at the wind patterns off the cliff. They somehow know when it is the right time that they can take off. And they also tell me sometimes the time windows for takeoff are as brief as 5 minutes. If you miss the 5 minute window, then you're not going to be able to soar for hours up there in the sky. Eagles seem to know all that. So the eagle's brain is somehow able to monitor these environmental features and basically know. And so you'll often see an eagle just sitting in a tree, just sits there for hours, and then suddenly it takes off because it sees or knows the right conditions. It takes off. He knows that he can soar for hours on end. And if he soars for hours on end, chances are a mouse is going to come out of its hole sometime and they're going to get a meal. And because they're using so little energy and floating up there in the atmosphere, they're not consuming a lot of calories, just kind of surveying the scene. But also you notice the eagles don't do that over heavily forested land because there's just so much vegetation there. Their superior vision really isn't going to help them that much. So they pick the open territory. And as you look at the book of Job, it contrasts the hawk with the eagle. The hawk is beautifully designed to hunt in heavily forested areas, whereas the eagle is designed to hunt in open territory, but mainly because the eagle has got different eyes. But we see this here in the text. The way of an eagle in the sky, and the fact that it can just soar up there effortlessly for so many hours, and then it spots something and it's able to get him. By the way, what kind of an, you know, if you're 2 miles away from a mouse, how do you get to that mouse before the mouse disappears?
Wow.
And what happens is the eagle changes its flight pattern. And so instead of kind of the soaring thing, it basically pulls all of its wings in and dive bombs. Because it's heavy enough that if it pulls its wings in, it's going to get to the ground in a real hurry and hit that mouse with so much force that it's going to have a meal. But the other amazing thing about the eagle is the way it can break itself. Because, I mean, if it were just to soar right down on top of that mouse, it would kill itself, right? But the way of an eagle is, when it does that to dive to get that little mouse, at the very last minute, it does this amazing thing with its wings, so it actually is able to catch the mouse with its talons without doing serious damage in terms of the dive bomb it's just pulled off. So, I mean, we know a lot more about eagles today because we've been able to study their eyes in detail. We know a lot more about eagles today because we've actually tried to build craft that can do the same things that eagles do. And by the way, again, those of you who have done hang gliding or paragliding, we don't do it as well as eagles do. Even with all of our technology, we cannot emulate the ease with which eagles can make that gliding operation work. And that's basically how people have designed these parachute devices and hang gliders. They studied the eagle and basically tried to copy the designs of the eagle.
One of the things to note about eagles is they're a very nest-fashioned animal. They actually mate for life. Mm-hmm. And they take turns, you know, sitting on the eggs, so even in environments where it snows. You know, the eagles will take turns keeping the eggs warm even in snow. And so they're amazing animals as far as their bonding, their mourning. I mean, their emotions are the most very close to humans as far as being mated for life and mourning the death of their mate.
It is. And again, I've been recommending you go outside and watch this stuff, but it's hard to actually spend time watching an eagle take care of its young. But you can go to one of these devices, your smartphone or an iPad. And there's actually websites you can go to where literally on a daily basis they kind of show you what's going on with these mother and father eagles caring for their young. We actually had a couple of our employees that do that at our office, where every day new photos would be posted, video clips, showing the parent eagles taking care of the little eaglets and getting them ready to fly and then kind of pushing them out and being able to train them how to fly. You can actually watch that on a daily basis on the internet. So, because after all, where are you going to go to find an eagle's nest today, and who's got the time to watch what happens there every day? But I'll tell you what's really fun at our Reasons to Believe office. Jeff Zwiering's office overlooks this tree where there's a hummingbird nest. And what's been amazing for our employees is to watch these hummingbirds, first of all, lay these very tiny eggs.
Jelly
bean. Yeah, I mean, like the size of a jelly bean, literally. And how these little tiny hummingbirds come out. And again, how both parents work together to feed and raise those baby hummingbirds. So yeah, if you come by our office, go to Jeff's office, and you can watch these baby hummingbirds being raised. So it is amazing. But I think something else that Dave was pointing out, eagles, and there's another reason why they make it into Job 39, is the way they bond to us human beings. If you can make a pet out of an eagle, it makes a really great pet, very affectionate pet. And you can actually train an eagle to catch stuff for you if you happen to like mice meat. Yeah, eagles are wild, but they can be tamed, just like all the nephesh creatures can be tamed.
Eagles are still called falconry. Even just hawks, the eagles and falcons. Hawks can do falconry with them.
Well, I had a friend who had a pet eagle, and that eagle just loved to take his head and stroke it against his owner's head and get pets, and, you know, very affectionate animal. And, you know, forms a very strong bond with human beings. And it will actually go and hunt for you. If, again, you like food like mice and rats and rabbits.
You'll get rabbits.
You'll get rabbits too, right? Maybe you can train it to get the kind of food you like. I don't know. So, but that's the way of an eagle in the sky. So, how many have ever watched a snake on what it says here, a snake on the way of a rock? You know, it's one thing for a snake to move through sand. Well, what about on rock? And by the way, snakes are difficult for the evolutionists to explain. How does an animal go from having legs to having no legs? And you're thinking, you know, mobility without legs is going to be more severe. What's really going on here? So, yeah, anybody want to take a stab at trying to explain? By the way, do you all know how snakes move? They don't have legs. They got muscles. Yeah, it takes muscles to move. It takes the ribs. Now, here we got somebody who taught science in school. Had a snake in school, yeah. And so you can do that with children. You know, get a snake and kind of show them how the snake moves on a very smooth surface. And that's kind of what this point is making. It's one thing to explain how snakes move on, you know, say, sand or gravel. But how does it move on a very smooth surface? And you can do that with a snake. Actually, put it on an extremely smooth surface, polished brass or aluminum, for example, and that snake is able to move, even on something that's very slippery. But it's the way it moves. It basically has these ribs that can be moved. Our ribs don't move, or at least don't move well, but the snake's ribs do, and it's got lots of ribs. So it basically has muscles that move the ribs back and forth, and it's able to inch along. That and the fact that it takes a serpentine motion, where it basically has kind of an S-type shape and is able to move it. And by the way, you see that most frequently with snakes that live in sandy or gravelly areas, because the serpentine movement, basically the snake looks for a rock or a clump of sand that's more in place than the rest of the sand or the gravel that's there, and kind of pushes its body against that, which has more resistance than the rest of it. So even in loose sand, a sidewinder, for example, can move in loose sand. But what that sidewinder is doing is basically looking at the terrain that it's in, this very loose, soft sand, and is looking for clumps of sand that have a little more resistance than the rest of the sand. It only has to be a tiny bit more resistance. If it finds that, it can use its muscles to push very gently. And by the way, it has to be a gentle push. If you push too hard, you basically push the sand away and you don't get any traction. So, but because of how long the snake is and how many ribs it's got and all the muscles it's got, it only needs to push a little bit against that part of the sand or the gravel that's got slightly more resistance. Now, I can imagine people living 3,000 years ago looking at the snake and saying, I can't figure out how it's able to pull that off. But hey, with modern biology and anatomy, we've been able to actually cut these snakes open and kind of figure out exactly how it all works and how they're able to pull this off. I don't know whether you did that in your biology class. That was one of the things we had to do, is dissect a snake and kind of figure some of these things out. So I don't know whether you did that in your biology classes or not. You do frogs? Yeah, we had to do a frog. We had to do a frog, a rat, a fish, and earthworms, a snake. So we did not do cadavers. So. But this is the way of a snake on a rock. And then the way of a ship on the high seas. What do you think it's talking about when it refers to the ship on the high seas? What's mysterious about a ship on the high seas? Again, put yourself back 3,000 years ago.
Was this before they had discovered tacking?
Okay, you're on to something. Tacking was used by humans very early. So it's not just modern sailboats that tack. It literally goes back thousands of years. So even back when this is written, tacking was a standard technique for ships on the high seas. Yeah, and what's mysterious about tacking?
Define tacking.
Well, this is supposed to be a class that's really smart, right? Come on. By the way, I've got something in my new book that's called The Grand Tack. If you want to see something that's really amazing about the early history of our solar system, just Google something called The Grand Tack, because there's actually a tacking phenomenon that happened in the early history of our solar system. But yeah, those of you who are sailors, what is tacking?
So the amazing thing about tacking is you can actually sail into the sun, into the wind.
Yeah. You can sail into the wind. So, you know, here's the wind coming right at you, and you're going straight into the wind, and you're making progress. You're able to do that. Why?
Zigzag.
You zigzag. So you go this way, and you go this way, you go this way, you go that way.
It
takes a lot longer. But and also the sail has to be designed in such a way that you're actually getting the right geometry of the pushing of the wind. So, yes, pushing this way, but actually gets you a little bit of progress off to an angle. So you kind of tack back and forth like this, and you can actually make pretty good progress. I mean, if you've been in a sailboat and you got, say, a 20 or 30 mile an hour wind pushing directly at you, you can actually go forward at a rate of about 10 miles an hour. So it's amazing how fast forward you can go even in the face of a strong wind. So
it's sort of like using a planet's gravitational pull to
yes, although with the gravitational slingshot effect, you're actually going in a direction. This is where you're actually going the opposite direction of the forces that are pushing against you. That's truly what's amazing about a ship on the high seas. The fact that it's so counterintuitive. Here's a ship making progress in a particular direction against the high seas. But other interpreters of this text have made the point just how amazing it is. And by the way, when it talks about the high seas, so often when you're on the high seas, you can't see any land. But what's amazing about ancient mariners, they seem to know where they were and where they were going, even when they're on the high seas, without modern technology. But here's a caveat. Recent discovery indicates that the Greeks, 3,000 years ago, had navigation devices that enabled them to figure out where they were, the direction they were going, even though they couldn't see the sun or the stars, and they couldn't see any land. So evidently, the ancient mariners were highly motivated to develop the technology. Basically, they discovered these ancient Greeks had these amazing clocks that worked quite well, and they had these sextant-type devices where they could actually figure out where they were. So, and this is important to be able to navigate, say, across the Mediterranean Sea or the oceans of ancient times. Proverbs is probably written in the day of Solomon. And Solomon talks about these voyages that his sailors would take to these faraway countries, where, again, they wouldn't be able to see land, and it'd be overcast like it is today. How do you figure out where you are? Yes?
Would your point on the tacking and the navigation that back then they knew about these things and how to use them, but they didn't know why they worked, and that's why the I don't understand part?
Yeah. I mean, today we have all the physics and math to figure out exactly what's going on. They just kind of figure it out by trial and error and be able to build better sails. I mean, what you notice about the ancient sailing ships, for example, their sails were nowhere near as well designed as sails we have today to be able to tack into a strong wind. You know, I was talking earlier how you can actually move forward 10 miles an hour, even in a strong wind. That was not the case 3,000 years ago, but they were still able to make progress. But yeah, I mean, you're sitting on the shore. Why is that ship able to go in that direction when the wind is going in the opposite direction? That's kind of what it talks about, the mystery of this. And how is it that these sailors can go to a faraway place and know where they're going and know where they are? And actually know the rate at which they're going and when they're going to get there. Hey, we're out of time, so We'll get to the tough stuff. What about the way of a man with a woman? What's so different about the courtship of humans compared to the courtship of ancient peoples? And by the way, I think there's also going to get into a more a contemporaneous discussion. What is it that's happened to human courtship today that's very different from the courtship that most likely existed 3,000 years ago? And again, I kind of bring at the point, our urbanization has had an impact on us. So, because, well, I won't go into this, but part of the courtship is the man getting beautiful things from nature to give to the woman he wants to impress. Whereas today, what does he do? He gives her an iPad or a smartphone. All right. So that just gives you a little bit of a teaser where I'm going to try to take you next week. But by the way, since this is a real challenge for me personally, I'm really counting on you to provide the content for that part next week. And then we'll get into the rest of Proverbs 30. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for this time we've had in this amazing book of Proverbs, and just how much of the book of Proverbs really challenges us to look at what's going on in nature, the creatures that you've made there in nature, and how you designed them not only to serve us and to please us, but to teach us crucial lessons about ourselves, about you, and how we can come into relationship with you. So, Father, I pray you continue to reward us with rich insights from these texts and give us many opportunities, Lord, to point people to both the book of Scripture and the book of nature, through which you so abundantly have revealed yourself. In Jesus' name, amen.